The final case on our argument docket today is Raymond Padilla v. State, case number 73353. Mr. Gatney?
Opposing counsel was just here.
Oh, okay.
She's here.
Oh, hang on then. We'll wait till she is able to get in the courtroom. That's okay, Ms. Craigs. No problem. We understand. Are you ready to go? Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Gaffney.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for
all right.
If I might. And may it please the court, counsel for the state, my name is Lucas Gaffney. I am the attorney for Raymond Padilla, the appellant in this case. He was convicted by way of a jury of one count of ownership or possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. As argued through our opening brief, there were several significant errors committed by the district court during the trial and the pretrial proceedings here. And these errors, when taken collectively, prevented Mr. Padilla from receiving a fair trial. And so our request to this court is that Mr. Padilla's conviction be reversed and case remanded for a new trial. So with the court's permission, the first issue I'd like to address is a error that occurred during the pretrial proceedings, and that was the district court's denial of Mr. Padilla's motion to suppress.
I'd like to ask a question with that.
Sure.
Preliminary. I read in the record at calendar call, and I want to make sure I'm correct factually, that the vehicle was given back to the girlfriend's mother, who both owned the vehicle, and it was registered to that person as well?
That's my understanding, is that it was registered to Maya Tolango's mother.
Right, and it was owned by her as well.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
So my question is, and it wasn't raised by the district attorney nor the district court, but my question is, how does your client have standing to assert a Fourth Amendment violation in this case when the automobile was not his and it wasn't registered to him? How does he have an expectation of privacy within the console? I realize it wasn't raised, but it struck me that that's the first question you ask in a Fourth Amendment case.
Interesting. So my response would be that my understanding of Mr. Padilla's relationship with Maya Tarango is that they were living together and that he had her permission to use the vehicle via, and she was essentially in possession of the vehicle that her mom owned. She was using it on a regular basis.
And is so this in the record somewhere, all of this?
You know, Your Honor, I don't know. I believe that it may be discussed in the preliminary hearing transcript as to who was the registered owner of the vehicle, but whether he had, what were the sort of levels, I guess, of permission or ownership of the vehicle that reached Mr. Padilla, that I do not know.
Right, and if it was a prelim in front of Judge Lee, which I believe it was, and although I didn't go into that preliminary, am I correct that just the officers would have testified to those facts? Nothing, he didn't take the stand, or the girlfriend didn't take the stand, or the mother took the stand.
That's correct. Maya Tarango and the mother never was put under oath and asked questions about their ownership or registration of the vehicle. Officer Nickenbacher, who was the second officer who stopped Mr. Padilla July 26, 2016, he testified as well as, I believe, another officer.
Well, I guess that goes back to, how does your client have standing in this case on a Fourth Amendment violation?
Your Honor, I guess I would submit it on, he had permission from Maya Tarango, who was the regular user of that vehicle, to drive the vehicle on that day. And as noted in throughout the record, there were various pieces of, or various items in the car that were belonged to Mr. Padilla. There was some paperwork in the center console along with where the firearm was found. He had, I think, several items that he owned in the car. And you're right, I don't think it was ever clear in the record as to what his sort of ownership or possession of that vehicle was. But my understanding was that he had permission to use the vehicle that day. I think what came out...
I read the record. I read the record at the hearing, and the officer testified that he gave the vehicle back to the mother of the girlfriend because she owned the vehicle, and the vehicle was registered to her. That's the testimony I saw.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Gaffney, did the state contest standing?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Are you disputing that based on the 911 call and the unique, orange with the rims description of the vehicle, that the officer did not have reasonable suspicion to contact that vehicle at that time?
Well, it's not necessarily that they didn't have reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle. What we're arguing is that it's not clear based on the record whether the officers believe Mr. Padilla was armed and dangerous.
Okay, so the stop, probably reasonable suspicion.
Right.
Taking him out of the car. Are you contesting them taking him out of the car?
No, that was due to him not having a driver's license. Okay. So when they took him out of the car, that I wouldn't say that that was necessarily abnormal. But what we are contesting is that based on the 911 call and the brief amount of information that was received, whether or not the police actually had reason to believe that he was armed and dangerous, because the 911 call, the caller described hearing, not seeing, but hearing three what he believed to be gunshots. So we're not even sure of what he actually heard were gunshots. He described three different vehicles, and yes, I would have to concede that Mr. Padilla's vehicle, the orange Chevy Avalanche with chrome rims, is fairly distinctive. I wouldn't go as far as saying that that might be the only one in Las Vegas, but sure, it's a fairly distinctive vehicle. But what we don't have is a description of Mr. Padilla, what Mr. Padilla's role, if any, was, would have been in the firing of the, the gunshots were. There were no weapons in plain view when both of the officers went to the passenger side and the driver's side of the vehicle. There was no weapons found on Mr. Padilla during the Terry frisk.
What standard are we applying at the point they enter the car?
So, Your Honor, I would be relying on that the police officer has to possess a reasonable belief based on specific and articulable facts taken together with the rational inference from those facts that would reasonably warrant the officers believing that the suspect, in this case Mr. Padilla, is dangerous and may gain immediate control of weapons. And so what that requires is whether a reasonably prudent person in this circumstance would be warranted in their belief that the safety of themselves or others was in danger.
So you don't think they need probable cause at that point to enter the console?
I think probable cause if they had reason to believe a crime had been committed and that there was evidence of a crime located in the vehicle. And so I would argue that in the alternative, yes, they didn't have reasonable belief that a crime had been committed and that Mr. Padilla had committed that crime. But in terms of whether or not they could perform a protective sweep of the vehicle based on the information they had, that's the standard I just provided to the court. And so, you know, our position is that given the amount of limited information that was provided to these officers, they did not know whether Mr. Padilla was armed and dangerous. And that would have, should have triggered Judge Villani to order an evidentiary hearing, to hear from these officers firsthand to determine whether or not they actually thought their safety may be in danger, whether they believe they had, just based on the 911 call, reasonable, whether there was a safety sweep was necessary to go into that middle console. And unfortunately, there wasn't a evidentiary hearing in this case.
But didn't the officers testified at a preliminary hearing? And I'm assuming, I didn't go into the whole prelim, but I'm assuming that defense had the opportunity to cross-examine. And we certainly know that there's no mandate for an evidentiary hearing if you can look back at the record and see what happened.
So the officer that testified was Officer Nickenbacher. There were two officers that had arrived on the scene. Officer Nickenbacher arrived after the first officer, which was Officer Reitz. Nickenbacher was the officer that stood back with Mr. Padilla between the end of Mr. Padilla's truck and the patrol vehicle and performed the Terry frisk. Simultaneously, you have Officer Reitz going into the vehicle and conducting a search. Officer Reese didn't testify at the preliminary hearing.
I did see, though, Officer Reese testify at the calendar call, at an evidentiary hearing, and all of this was gone into. Why didn't the defense renew its motion to suppress after he testified? Because I did read all that. And I read Officer Reese's testimony, but in a different context, in the district court, after the initial motion to suppress was denied.
And that I can't answer. What I do know is that when Judge Villani made his decision, he hadn't heard a lot of what I would call these significant facts. What we don't know is whether the officers would have, for instance, let Mr. Padilla re-enter his vehicle for any reason, because that's one of the justifications they give for giving for doing the protective sweep, is that, hey, if the suspect tries to make a break for his car, we want to make sure there's no weapons within arm's reach. Well, we don't have any testimony to that effect. We also don't know,
I have a question, another factual question as to another issue, which is the bifurcation issue. My question is, when I went back into the record, I noticed that it was just a one-line email to the district attorney saying, hey, I'm going to orally request this be bifurcated, and you cite to a case. And it was the DA that actually just filed a written motion in response to your email that was in opposition to the motion to bifurcate, also citing to the Barker case, the Ninth Circuit case. And then you file your reply. How is an email to the district attorney, do you think that preserved the issue? You never actually filed a motion to bifurcate in this case. And my second part of that question is, at the end of this discussion or what the district court did, you stipulated and agreed to what the district court did, which is nothing was mentioned as to what felony it was, or the date of the felony. It just came in he was a felon. So there's a stipulation at the end as well.
Sure.
Can you answer those questions?
Well, I wasn't trial counsel, but my position would be that they didn't file the motion, they sent an email, but when the state took it upon themselves to file a response, and then the defense filed a reply, and then the district court addressed the issue, that preserved the bifurcation issue for this court's review.
So emails are good for motions?
I wouldn't go as far as saying emails are good for motions, but I think once it becomes a discussion in the court, whether it's prompted by an email, whether it's prompted on the fly just by making an oral motion at calendar call or in the first day of trial, that should be enough to preserve the record for that.
And what you wanted was just not to say what type of felony or the year, and you got that through the stipulation. You got that.
Well, the problem with the bifurcation issue was at the very beginning of trial, they read the information, and the information includes that he was an ex-felon convicted of robbery with use of a deadly weapon.
The clerk read that part?
Correct.
Despite your stipulation?
I think that's my understanding, Judge. I can go back and look at the record
we'll look at those.
May it please the court. Genevieve Craig for the state. I'd like to start by talking about the alleged bad act evidence that was discussed in appellant's brief, if the court would be amenable to that. Firstly, Your Honors, I would submit to the court that there are multiple alleged bad act evidence that's not actually bad acts. And additionally, if the court does find that some of these are bad acts, the prejudicial effect of these does not substantially outweigh the probative value. First of all, Your Honors, the prior contact with the police, the initial stop of this orange Chevy Avalanche that occurred about a month and a half earlier. As you know, we did file a motion, a bad act motion, to try to get the full pieces, factual pieces of that stop in. And Judge Villani said no to that. He actually sanitized it down to the point where the only thing that was brought up in court in the trial was that a different police officer had seen the defendant driving that vehicle previously. That's all that was brought in. That's not a bad act, Your Honors. That is simply It wasn't even that he got pulled over. It wasn't even that it was a valid stop. It was simply that he had seen the defendant driving that vehicle before, which is obviously probative to the state's case because we're trying to show that the defendant had knowledge of that firearm in the vehicle, and the fact that he had driven that car more than once was probative to show that. Additionally, there was discussion in the appellant's brief about the actual police contact from that day. And again, the district court prohibited the state from talking about the fact that there was a 911 call, from talking about the fact that there were any gunshots, anything along those lines, and it was sanitized down to the point where there was a stipulation between the parties that the defendant was pulled over during a valid stop. The only questions that were asked to the officer about that were...
Can I ask you a question? Why didn't, and I didn't read that actual excerpt, but if you knew that the gunshot residue in his call was coming in, why would it even matter that shots were fired? Was that argued to the district court, what I'm saying right now?
The gunshot residue portion?
Yeah, because you have jail calls from him talking about the shooting. Did you argue to the district court, or did the state argue to the district court? Well, who cares? They're going to hear this anyway.
I know at some point after it was determined that we would be using that jail call, there was a discussion between my co-counsel and the judge about the gunshot residue.
When was it determined that you would use that call?
My recollection of that, Your Honor, is that it was just a week beforehand. Because I know there was also discussion about the fact that the calls were turned over. The defense argued that they had been turned over late. The state argued that we were going through 400 and some calls and narrowed it down to 2, and that the agreement had been that we would turn the ones over that we actually wanted to use, or in the alternative, we could turn 400 and some over months in advance.
Thank you.
So in terms of the actual contact, it was sanitized down to the point where it was just a valid traffic stop, that a police officer was dispatched to the specific area. There wasn't even any discussion of why he was dispatched to that specific area. And then there was the stipulation that was entered into. So I would submit, Sharon, that's not a bad act either. It's simply there was a traffic stop and we didn't talk about anything else. There's also discussion of the lab number issue that came up with the DNA analyst.
Yeah, quick question on that. If you're a DNA expert, you had a DNA expert testify.
We did.
That there was inconclusive DNA taken.
Correct.
So why even put that piece in where you have to say there's some lab number, even though I appreciate it's tangential. I'm just curious, why even put that in to say it's nothing?
And I think we also put up the fingerprint expert as well, the fingerprint analyst, and we did not have fingerprints either. The idea, I think, behind that is to show the jury that we are taking every possible effort that we can in order.
And I appreciate that, but then why would you elicit and why would you ask the question about it being in another case number? Because obviously a buccal swab can be used for multiple case numbers, and yet you or your co-counsel intentionally asked the question, which then again reaffirms with an elicited answer of a different case number, which can only mean one thing: there's another case out there.
And my recollection and rereading that portion of the record, Your Honor, is that, and it's cited in one of the briefs, I think it's cited in our response, is that actually my co-counsel asked initially, did you generate a profile? And the DNA analyst responded and actually said, under this case number? And then she says...
No, I read it. And okay. The question was elicited, did you take a buccal swab? And it was something to the effect of under this other case number. And then the answer was yes, it was under another case number, the buccal swab.
I understand your question, Your Honor. My recollection of it was that it was not a purposeful thing. It was that the DNA analyst asked for clarification. My co-counsel said under another case number. And then we approached, had the discussion at the bench. It was determined that, according to the district court judge, that it was just a statement said in passing, that the jury would not, because it was lab case number, not other criminal case, that the jury wouldn't be able to tell what that meant, wouldn't be able to infer reasonably that that meant he had another case in the system. And then the defendant was given an opportunity to have a cautionary instruction and decided against doing that.
If we determined it was error, why would it be harmless error?
It would be harmless error because the jury doesn't have an understanding in order to know that another lab case number means anything other than there's another lab case number. For all they know, there could be multiple lab case numbers, there would be multiple tests done. They don't have the knowledge to infer the fact that that would be a prior case or another case. And additionally, I would point out they also, there was a stipulation that he was a felon. So they did already know that at some point he had been convicted of another crime. So that would also lend it to harmless error as well. The photographs in the vehicle, I would contend that those are not prior bad acts. They were simply headsets that were in the back of the vehicle. They went to show the appellant's knowledge that potentially there was a firearm in the vehicle as well. And going to the jail call and the dissuading of the witness, which the appellant alleged was also a bad act. In terms of what was discussed regarding the actual call, the discussion was about the defendant's consciousness of guilt, not about him dissuading the witness. I mean, the discussion between, and first of all, she wasn't a witness. She was never called as a witness in this case. She's the girlfriend whose mom owns the car. So he calls her up, and in the record, in my closing statement, I essentially verbatim read everything into the record. And they go back and forth, and he's just telling her, this is what you should put in this affidavit. And at one point, you can hear her typing it out. This absolutely goes to show his consciousness of guilt, that he understood that he was essentially telling his girlfriend to write an affidavit to the district attorney's office, telling us that, you know, it was just an accident, and also discussing different ways that they could explain his DNA being on the firearm. So, Your Honors, based on that, and the case Reese v. State from 1979 here in Nevada does discuss how consciousness of guilt evidence can come in, even if potentially there's a criminal piece of it as well.
What do you say to his accusation that the clerk read in that he was a felon, is what the stipulation was? And my recollection of the transcript was that both sides agreed that at the end of the day, after that motion and the discussion, the stipulation between the parties was that the clerk would read he's a felon, and that was it. No, not what it was for or the date. What is your recollection? Did the clerk read in the robbery with use of a deadly weapon?
I'm sorry. My recollection is no. I believe that part of the record, too, was those typed out. There were two typed out stipulations, one regarding that traffic stop or the stop, mm-hmm. the valid stop, and the other regarding his felon status. I also recall a discussion about how initially defense did want to stipulate to him being a felon, but then also wanted to be able to say that it was from 1991, but then didn't want to say what the actual charge was. And then there was discussion back and forth about how our position was you get it all or you get nothing, and the district court ended up agreeing, you know, if you want to talk about the year, that's fine, but you have to talk about the actual charge. And then they decided against it after they had a discussion, and then we created the stipulation. So I don't have any recollection that the jury was read anything other than the stipulation that's in the record.
And that's what I read. That's why I didn't know if it went astray or... But that the thing that the jury only knew that he was a felon and that was it.
Yes, but he was a felon. I don't believe they knew the date. I don't believe they knew the charge. It was simply just the stipulation that was agreed to by both parties and by the court itself. In terms of the search, which I don't know if Your Honors would like to discuss that
further.
Okay. I would submit that clearly these officers had reasonable, articulable suspicion and concern that the defendant could potentially be armed at the time. I mean, we have...
You have a 911 caller that says, I think are shots, mm-hmm. and there's cars fleeing the scene. Because I know if I hear shots, my car is going to be fleeing the scene too. So you have somebody thinks there's shots and cars fleeing the scene. So... that gets you to maybe pull over the car, maybe gets him out once he says, I don't have a license. How do you get in the console at that point? I think that's that's a decision point.
I understand. And I think that the fact that, first of all, we've also discussed that it's a very distinctive vehicle, of course.
Sure.
So, and I guess the appellant's not disputing the fact that the stop was valid. In Michigan v. Long, the United States Supreme Court talked a lot about the inherent dangerousness of police officers doing stops with automobiles, because there are so many places that weapons can be hidden, and it goes on for a while talking about how this particular situation for patrol officers is so inherently dangerous that there has to be a balancing test between somebody's privacy, personal security, and then the law enforcement officer's ability to do their job and feel safe. And in that context, they talk about different situations in which the officers would need to get into the vehicle, and specifically talk about how the passenger compartment is a place that defendants or folks that are, I guess, not defendants yet, but that have been pulled out of their vehicle are going to be able to reach.
Okay, but he's separated from the car. There's nobody else in the car. Now, do they just have carte blanche to search the car? Is that your position? Like, what is it that allows him at that point? It's unclear because we don't have a hearing.
Right.
At that level, was he going to be cited for no license? Was the car, it's kind of like we don't know if we're going to tow it. So it's not an inventory tow search because it's not being towed. So what is the nature of the search at that point where he is separated from the vehicle, clearly not free to leave at that point, that allows him to go into the console?
And what we argued in our briefing was that it was a Terry frisk or a protective sweep. And I would go back to Michigan Belong and say that the argument in that case was the fact that the defendant or the person who was under arrest at that point.
I have a question. A Terry frisk of a car?
Yes.
Okay. That's what you're calling it. A Terry frisk of a car.
Or a protective sweep.
Okay. And I've never heard of a Terry frisk of a car until I saw this case.
Okay.
I never saw that.
And I could.
I was like, tell me the case that talks about Terry frisking a car.
And I would call it potentially a protective search, protective sweep. Maybe that would be more accurate. But it's from Michigan Belong 462 U.S. 1032 1983. And that one talks about, essentially, it cites to Terry versus Ohio, and then talks about how in the court below, my understanding is the court below had reversed and remanded that case because the officers in that case had done essentially a protective sweep of the car and called it and essentially used Terry to try to justify it. The lower court had reversed and remanded that and said that's not appropriate. A Terry frisk is not of a vehicle or anything but the person. And then the Supreme Court came back and said, actually, no, we're going to extend our ruling. It can actually be a vehicle as well, and talks about, and that's when they kind of go on and on about the inherent concern for law enforcement officers in their automobiles, or with automobile stops, excuse me.
So what facts exist in the record, either in the preliminary hearing or in the discussion at the calendar call, or anywhere else in this record that demonstrates the facts necessary for a protective sweep under that case in this instance?
Yes. The fact that there were a 911 call, that there were gunshots heard, that there was a very distinctive vehicle that was reported. The officers in this case got to the exact area where that call came from in less than 10 minutes. And the orange Chevy Avalanche was found just blocks from where that 911 call was called in with the gunshots. Additionally, when they pulled him over, there was testimony from the patrol officers that he appeared to be very nervous, that his demeanor was nervous, and then they pulled him out of the vehicle and he didn't have a license. The fact that it was a distinctive vehicle that was only minutes and blocks from where that 911 gunshot call was made is enough to give them reasonable suspicion to pull the vehicle over. And then, because of the fact that it was gunshots that were reported, because of his demeanor and because of the distinctive vehicle and the timing and the location, because of the inherent dangerousness to them pulling him out of that vehicle and there possibly being a gun just in that general area. And I'm not trying to argue that they can search the whole car. I'm just arguing.
Well, why not? If they had to open the console, it wasn't visible. Why not? Why wouldn't they have a license to look underneath the tires or in the trunk if it had a trunk? It sounds like this protective sweep concept is pretty extensive.
Well, the protective sweep...
Where are the guardrails on this protective sweep, and how would we be able to assess that under the facts of this case, where the defendant is away from the car, in the custody of the cops? One of the guys who's conducting this search is there by himself. He can see there's nobody in it.
It's essentially...
What's the threat to the officers? That's what I'm trying to ask.
And the threat to the officers is at that point, we don't know if, and they talk about this in Michigan Be Long, not to hammer a dead horse, but they talk about how specifically, if just because somebody is pulled out of the vehicle, if they're not in custody, it's possible that they could run and get back into that vehicle. It's possible that they'll be let back into that vehicle. They go through multiple scenarios similar to this one where he's not in custody, he's not right next to the vehicle, but it's possible that he could go back to the vehicle. And the protective suite specifically is for places that that individual could have reached when they're sitting in that car. And they talk specifically about the passenger compartment and the console. And my understanding is that the firearm was found right next to that driver's side area, right inside that console. So the sweep is only the place that the arrestee can get to, and the gun was found in this case right next to him inside that console. They also talk specifically about how it is permissible to look into compartments as well.
Chief, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
So the two Michigan prongs, suspect is dangerous and may gain immediate control of the weapons.
Yes.
So let's start with suspect is dangerous at the time of the search, because there's conflicting testimony about his demeanor. Because until that different officer testified at trial, the only testimony you had, and you had multiple instances of testimony, was he was cooperative, he was appropriate, no sweat, no nervous, nothing. Then at trial, one officer recalls it a little bit differently. That seems to support your position. But now he's out of the car, he's cooperated, he's told he doesn't have a license, you search him, he has no weapons. What reasonable and articulable facts, can you point to that at that time, now when he's going in the car, this suspect is dangerous?
That minutes ago, his vehicle had been reported as leaving the scene of gunshots.
Three vehicles were reported fleeing a scene where gunshots were heard. There was no testimony that he shot, maybe saw him with a weapon. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So your position then would be any one of those vehicles, any compartments are fair game.
And I apologize for interrupting.
No, please.
I think, one, it depends on, if they called in and said, a white Ford Focus, and then they're pulling over every white Ford Focus. In this situation, it's such a distinctive vehicle. We know that vehicle was at the scene, and that vehicle was specifically called in by that 911 caller. And that additionally, and I've said this already, but additionally that it was so close in time. And
that 9 minutes.
And that it was very close in location as well, just a few blocks away. So yes, that's my position. And under Michigan Be Long and the inherent dangerousness of automobile stops, particularly when you don't have the suspect in custody, those two things together create a appropriate stop in this
case.
And
gaining immediate control would be a whole series of ifs.
Yes.
If they let him out and they let him go away, then he...
And I would
immediately
say,
gain control.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
And I would say that, again, those different types of ifs are discussed, because an argument that's made in that case is specifically that individual was no longer in the vehicle. So why do the officers then have an opportunity to go through and do this protective sweep when he's not in the vehicle any longer? And they talk about all these different scenarios in which somebody, if they're not under arrest, can get back to their vehicle, maybe let back into their vehicle. And because of that, they can do this very, very limited search for officer safety, which is what was done here.
Ms. Craig, if this court were to disagree with your analysis on this subject and find error with respect to the suppression of the weapon, is there any reason this case should be remanded for a new trial?
That it should be remanded for a new trial?
Right.
Is there any reason why it would be remanded?
I'm sorry, I guess I'm not understanding the question. I apologize.
If this court disagrees with your analysis and believes there was error in suppressing the weapon, that it should have been suppressed, is there any reason this case should be remanded for a new trial?
Our request, Your Honor, if you do disagree with that, it be remanded and we have an opportunity to do a full evidentiary hearing in that situation.
If we disagree with you, is there any basis to require a new trial in this case other than an outright reversal?
Not that I can think of, Your Honor.
Okay. I think you've gone over your time.
I think I have to.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, we went over with our questions with Ms. Craig. You'll have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you. To answer Justice Silver's question about reading the information to the jury, that can be found on Bates number 536 of the appellant's appendix. And what I'm looking at is there's, within parentheses, it says clerk reads information to the jury. I don't know if that was redacted information or if that information reflected what the stipulation of the parties were. That's what I was relying on.
But you were the trial counsel, you said.
No, I was not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Counsel. You said you were not.
Okay. Right. And I don't recall seeing a redacted information either in the computerized record or in the exhibits from trial.
I read the stipulation.
Okay.
So I was going by that stipulation.
Understood. And I just would like to address a couple of things that opposing counsel had mentioned about the DNA. One thing I think that's important to remember, you know, really what the state is relying on here is the jury's ignorance by saying a different case number doesn't necessarily translate to mean he has a different criminal case. But I think what's important to note is that the DNA expert that testifies introduced as Metro's DNA expert. She's essentially tied to law enforcement. Therefore, when she starts talking about different case number, we're not talking about a civil case. We're probably not talking about some kind of a misdemeanor. We're going to be talking about a criminal case and a criminal case that's serious enough to warrant taking somebody's DNA. And so when the jury hears that his DNA is collected under a different case number, you know, their imagination essentially can run wild as to what that means. If nothing else, it means that he was being investigated by the police as a suspect in a different case.
Well, but there's a stipulation that he's a felon. So why don't they just say, oh, maybe that, if we're talking about what they may speculate, why don't they just say, well, he's a felon, maybe that's where they got the DNA.
And maybe that's where the jury's mind goes, maybe not. We don't know. And when you throw in all of these other prior contacts that he had with the police, June 6th, July 26th, the DNA under a different case number, these could all prospectively be different cases, different contacts that he had with the police. And that's essentially what we were trying to argue in the opening brief as to the bad acts. Not that any one of them in isolation was enough to taint this trial with unfairness, but collectively, when you take a look at all the bad acts and the evidence that came in through those bad acts, and then also the arguments we made about the things that were said in closing argument, it's our position that there was enough error here to inject unfairness in the trial to the point where Mr. Padilla didn't receive due process. One of the other issues I'd like to address is Michigan v. Long. I know that the state is relying on that for their argument. However, I think that the facts in Michigan v. Long are distinctive from the facts of this case. One of the more distinctive facts is that in Michigan v. Long, the officers were about to let Long re-enter the vehicle to receive his registration when they noticed that there was a big knife on the floor in plain view. And no such facts like that exist in this case. There was no weapons in plain view for the officers. Long was driving his vehicle at excessive speed, and his car swerved into a ditch right in front of the officers. So they were able to observe the bizarre or, you know, the conduct, the inappropriate conduct. It occurred right in front of them as opposed to this sort of vague 911 call. The officers also indicated that Long was intoxicated. He wasn't answering questions. He was uncooperative. That is not the situation here. And you astutely pointed out that in the preliminary hearing, Officer Knickenbocker said he was very cooperative. He didn't seem to be nervous at all. And then, lo and behold, when we get to trial, that changes. The degree of dangerousness changes between when it's discussed in the preliminary hearing and when it's discussed at trial.
Did the defense request an evidentiary hearing on the motion to suppress in district court?
They did. And I don't have the reference for that. It was requested. I know it wasn't requested in their motion, but during the oral argument, trial counsel kind of at the end said, oh, Judge, by the way, we want an evidentiary hearing on this. And Judge Villani just said, no, I think I understand the facts of this case, and motion denied. And And Judge, to
counsel, at the beginning of your argument, you requested reversal in the order for a new trial. If the basis for reversal is error on the suppression of the weapon, why are we sending it back for a new trial?
That is a great question. If this court decides that the motion to suppress was decided wrongly, there's no point in sending this case back for a new trial. That is the crucial piece of evidence in this case. If the state is not allowed to present the firearm, then I can't see what a new trial would be about.
Okay, you're over your time. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefs in this case, and it will stand submitted. We'll be in recess. Thank you.